Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for your regular host, David Inge. Glad you could listen today. Our producers, by the way, are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and our technical director, Henry Frayne, at the controls. Here's a shocking revelation. American teens now spend more time on the internet than watching television. More time with the internet than TV? What's to become of our culture? Well, it's easy to joke about the decline of television, but the rise of the internet and its impact on our culture is no laughing matter. It's a great thing in so many ways, but it also creates new problems and accentuates some old ones. During this hour of Focus 580, we'll talk about how young people are using the internet and look at some of the ways this bodes well and ill for their education and personal development. Our guest is someone who spends a lot of time with people in the millennial generation, so-called those age 13 to 24, who basically they're growing up with the internet. Frances Jacobson Harris is the librarian at the University Laboratory High School here at the University of Illinois, where she has worked since the pre-web year of 1987. She team teaches a computer literacy course for 8th and 9th grade students that includes a strong focus on information literacy and the ethical use of information and communication technologies. And she is the author of a book we'll draw from during this hour of the show, entitled I Found It on the Internet, Coming of Age Online, recently published by the American Library Association Press. In the book, Frances Jacobson Harris guides us through some of the most relevant research on youth behavior on the internet, combined with her own experiences. We'll talk about that and try to provide some guidance on building information literacy in the internet age during this hour. As we talk with Frances Jacobson Harris, we invite you into the conversation. Your phone calls are welcome on the air here around Champaign-Urbana. The number is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you can hear us. If you're listening on the internet, in fact, 800-222-9455. Again, we welcome your questions during this hour. And to our guest, Frances Jacobson Harris, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
You start the book talking about teens and libraries, and always it's a very interesting subject, the reaction of teens to libraries, and I think it's become a lot more interesting since the internet has become such a big thing.
Definitely, definitely. When I first started in the library, our computers were dumb terminals that we had to boot up with a cassette tape. And library skills were pretty much ho-hum affairs, although, and so I would have to say the introduction of the internet has made learning about the library and about finding information a lot more interesting to teenagers, and we're able to really relate it to their lives in a way that I don't think was quite possible before.
Yeah, and a lot of people would say, well, with the internet, maybe there's less of a need for librarians. What would you say about that?
there's this top 10 list somewhere about that is, you know, now that we have the internet, why do we need libraries? And the answers are things like, well, we could, why spend, 2 hours trying to find something on Google when you could look it up in a book in 2 seconds,
right.
Kind of a thing.
Right.
And definitely, I think librarians are needed more than ever. I don't see the demise of the book in any way, shape, or form. If anything, it's more of a jungle out there than ever before. I think that the internet has certainly taken some of the drudgery out of searching and finding. Just as any teen would, I'm going to sit down at Google and type in, if I'm looking for something very specific, just type in those keywords, and chances are I'll find what I want very quickly. But if I need to know something in depth, anything that's really going to guide me farther than just getting a quick answer, then I'm going to need a lot more than that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as far as I'm concerned, librarians are the heroes of the information age. I mean, I'm not taking away from programmers or people who develop applications and so forth, but actually it seems that the librarians I know, they are the most expert people at using information technology. and actually, you know, for you know, actual human purposes.
Right. Thanks. I hope that's true. One thing I was telling a class yesterday is that there's this great thing out there called the invisible web, as opposed to the visible internet. The visible internet is anything you can get to through a search engine like Google, but the invisible web is all that information that's hidden behind a database wall or is password protected. So as an example, the lesson I was trying to teach was on using online databases, which are licensed by libraries, that get you to quality information. For example, in old back issues of periodicals, you can't find those by just going to Google. The information is not there. Or even all the fantastic information that you can get, say, at the Library of Congress, their digital collections of primary source images. Those are free, yes, so they're part of the free web. But if you do a search on Google, you won't find, say, these old advertisements. You have to search their database first. And that's the kind of thing that librarians really work at keeping up with. So, yeah, you're right.
Well, it's really interesting to note all the wealth of resources that are part of this invisible web, like you say, and most people aren't even aware that it exists.
Right.
One of the things I was curious about, and you write about some in the book, is the purposes that people bring to the library. They're usually, you know, they're given an assignment,
right,
and so they need to find some specific bit of information or something that could qualify as the right kind of information. And, you know, as you sort of describe, you know, they're there to get in and get out as fast as possible and maybe not bring the same critical, depth that they might if they really, really wanted to understand the full topic.
Right.
And maybe that isn't different in the internet age. It's just easier.
It is definitely easier. But I think one of the things we'd like to do is bring our teaching bring it more to the heart of what kids or people really want to know, and make it more part of their everyday life information seeking, so that you're not looking up a random fact that you don't care about, but you're looking up the random fact because it serves another purpose. And therefore, you want that random fact to not be so random and to address what you really want to know. Also, I think people come to the library for non-information purposes. They come to hang out. It's always been a social space. And one thing I did with the book was with the cover, there's a photo I took of kids in the library today. And then the photos that are around it, and here we are in the radio, and I'm describing something visual, but they come from old Uni High yearbooks. We found pictures of kids in the library from the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, and basically these are pictures of kids horsing around in the library to kind of show that the library... Some things don't change. Mm-hmm. That libraries have always been used for more than just information seeking, and they are spaces, they're places, even if they're virtual spaces. And so, I would say the library without walls fits into that rubric as well.
We're talking this morning during Focus 580 with Frances Jacobson Harris. She is the librarian at the University Laboratory High School. We call it Uni High,
yes,
here in Champaign-Urbana at the University of Illinois. And she's the author of the book we're discussing, I Found It on the Internet, Coming of Age Online. We did have a caller. Maybe I didn't include them as quickly as I should have, but let me mention the phone numbers again if you'd like to join us, and I'll do my best to not talk on myself too long. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Well, sort of building on the last thing you were talking about, we're talking about information technology, the internet, the web, et cetera. But you make, I think, a very important point that it's not just information technology. These are information and communications technologies.
Right.
Could you talk about that?
Well, kids have sort of two missions in life. This is a roundabout answer to your question. They need to understand who they are. It's an identity issue. And then they need to understand who they are in relationship to other people and in with the community. And they use both information and communication technologies to do that. And unlike us grown-ups or digital immigrants, as Mark Prensky coined those terms, digital immigrant and digital native, they are able to mix and match those technologies. So, for example, my son told me once about a friend who IM'd him a research paper and asked him to, I mean, I don't think it was a full-length research paper. It was probably a couple paragraphs, and said, would you proof this for me? Would you read this? So they're mixing those information and communication technologies. And teens, I think, don't see a big difference between the two. They'll use all those things interchangeably.
I want to follow up on that. We have a caller to get to, but real quickly here, you just used the term IM'd a research paper. Now, a lot of people will know what that is, but I bet there are people in our audience who don't even know. I mean, I'm not, right. I don't mean to criticize anyone for not knowing this. It's
absolutely
all new to a lot of people, and a lot of us are immigrants, not natives.
And I am definitely one of those immigrants. IM is instant messaging, and this is where you would be talking in quasi-real time online, usually on a computer, although there are other ways to do it. And it's sort of the updated version, I suppose, of walkie-talkies, only you're typing messages back and forth to each other. And one of the things you can do is transmit text or images. As well.
Okay. Well, I'm sure we'll talk more about IM. But let's talk with a caller, someone from Indiana on line number 4. Good morning.
A comment, which leads into a question and then a question, I guess.
Okay.
A comment is, I'm retired and an ex-teacher and all that good stuff. And I've been amazed at some of the family members, younger ones, who spend sometimes incredible amount of time when all they had to do is pick up a book, look in the index, and go to page 67, and there's what they wanted to look for things. Usually it's that you bring up too much information because you don't have the right string of words that would limit the search so that you would get up maybe just 10 things that would help you instead of, 5,000. So I'm wondering about that in terms of the general scope of just educating people. I sometimes wonder just what the Internet is going to do to some of those people in terms of initiative, I guess, is one question. And that's the comment leading into the question. And the second question is, I wondered if you have any views on Google's great play to monopolize everything, no matter who wrote it, when they wrote it, or will they ever write it. And that now I know there's a number of suits going against Google for copyright things. I know this is a technical subject, but I thought perhaps you could give some view of it from your perspective and working with students and, actually being a librarian. I guess those are two good, needy ones, I think, so I'll hop off.
Okay, thanks for the call.
I don't know if you saw that. I didn't see the actual issue of The Onion, but there was a joke about Google planning to destroy all information that it couldn't index.
I thought that was Microsoft. No, I'm kidding. That was a joke. That was a joke. I didn't mean it.
As to the first question, it's as a librarian, it's definitely very frustrating to watch kids spend huge amounts of time looking for information that they could find very easily by looking in a simple reference source or something as simple as a dictionary even or World Book. In terms of initiative, I think in a certain way they're showing it because they're very persistent. They'll just keep at it and keep at it and keep at it, which I find rather amazing. I think that is a skill that works in their favor if they're working on something that is more process-oriented. But when you're just trying to find the answer to something simple, it's kind of funny. In the school setting, that's, of course, something we work on quite a lot, and I could talk for a long time about how we handle it in the library in terms of creating online, webliographies, for lack of a better term. And the kids will laugh when I tell them that I will slap their hands if they go to Google first. In other ways, though, it works. And you can't fault them for trying. And so it's just sort of depends. And I would say that if you don't find the answer in 5 minutes, then cut your losses and go the other route. The other thing that happens, I think, sometimes, although this is not addressing the caller's question exactly, is that teachers will disallow certain types of sources, like encyclopedias. And I understand why they do that, but sometimes you just need the basic information first before you can go to the next step. But students will actually avoid some of the more obvious sources because they think they are not allowed to use them. In terms of Google, what's happening there, I think the latest hot spot is that Google is partnering with a number of large research libraries to scan their collections, and they're scanning both out-of-print volumes as well as in-print volumes. And nobody has any argument or problem with the scanning of the out-of-print volumes, and what you'll be able to do with that is search Google, find the books, and actually be able to read them online. With things that are still in copyright, and that doesn't mean they're in print, but they're either in copyright or in print, you will only be able to read a snippet or two or three of the book. I think that authors are very concerned about this, as are publishers, because while people won't be able to actually read the entire book online, Google will have nevertheless taken that intellectual property. They will have scanned those books, and they will have the intellectual work on their computers. My feeling about it is that the more the merrier. Let them in. It's all, for example, the other thing that will happen with Google Print is that Google will direct you to what libraries have those books. This is only going to increase use at libraries. And I think the same will happen with bookstores, publishers. People will be more likely to find these books. I see this as a transitional phase. It reminds me a whole lot of when VCR technology first came out, and people were all worried. The movie studios were all worried about that. And instead, they developed a new model. The industry developed a new model that had the effect of increasing the usage. I think, you know, the devil is in the details, and we'll see how it all works out. But I think in the long run, it is a good thing. It will increase readership. It will increase royalties to authors.
Hope that gets at the question. We're actually getting close to our midpoint here. Let me just reintroduce our guest again. We're speaking with Frances Jacobson Harris, author of the book I Found It on the Internet, Coming of Age Online, talking about how young people use the Internet for good and bad. It's a sort of a double-edged sword, certainly, but a lot of promise and potential and a lot of changes in what's going on. So if you have questions on that topic, you can join us, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana, toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. I'm certainly was intending to raise copyright issues, and maybe reserve that for a little bit later. I wanted to sort of pursue the question of the impact of information and communication technologies on the ways people relate to each other and the behaviors that we're seeing. And I know a lot of parents out there are seeing the same thing I am, which is my 11-year-old daughter designing web pages, editing images in Photoshop, instant messaging about eight of her friends at the same time, surfing the web. You know, maybe the TV's on in the background, but it's receded into the background. Mm-hmm. She doesn't really care about television pretty much. And so all these things are sort of a shift in the way people relate through electronic communication and the speed at which they relate and the number of threads. Just, I can't, you know, I can barely, you know, talk to one person at one time, you know, let alone eight. So, you know, this is common, would you say, in libraries?
It's very common.
Yeah.
And, well, you know that phrase, the expression information wants to be free. I think for a teenager, information wants to be shared. And yet at the same time, this is another one of those things that's not as new as it seems. I mean, I remember my mother yelling at me for having the radio on and talking on the phone while I was doing homework. Now they just have more stuff that they can do at the same time. And it's also, I think we finally figured out that it's not, in fact, isolating them. They're not going into a cave and just being on the computer all the time. They're actually communicating big time with all kinds of people. Also, I think they are more selective than we think they are. They've found ways to compensatory behaviors. So, for example, when they have six instant messaging conversations going at once, they don't feel the need to answer immediately, like you and I would, where we think it's rude to not answer right away. There are these pauses that are built in, and that's totally expected. They'll have windows minimized. They've found ways to compensate and manage all this multitasking. So it's not as hard as it looks, I suppose. It is for us, but I don't think it is for those natives.
Well, and I think another concern that I've heard people voice is that it's a further shortening of our attention span. That, you know, suddenly we're like doing all these things, and it's just speeding up our culture.
It could be. Although, as a librarian, I feel the same way. Yeah. That I've for the last 20 years, I've had to manage so many things at once that if I have to do something for longer than 5 minutes, I've lost it. So it's definitely a trade-off. It's definitely a trade-off.
We have a couple of callers to talk with.
Okay.
Let's do that. We'll go next to someone in Champaign-Urbana on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580. Caller there.
Hi, Mrs. Harris. This is Michael Pitt.
Hi, Michael.
Calling on behalf of the Uni High radio class.
Very cool.
Now, we were listening to your show, and we were wondering what you had to say about wikis and other innovative forms of, I guess, internet websites and things of that sort.
Excellent. Excellent. The wikis are collaborative online spaces. I think it's a Hawaiian word meaning quick, fast, something like that. And the most well-known wiki is probably Wikipedia, which is an online encyclopedia. I think wikis have tremendous potential actually in education environments because you can have what would be called a read-write environment where people are contributing content, editing each other's content. It's not a sequential medium. It's a collaborative medium. In the case of Wikipedia, because I'm sure people wonder about that, that's exactly what it is people, just anybody, creating this encyclopedia content on the web. And so it's really terrific for some things and really terrible for other things. And so, for example, if you go, I would use Wikipedia in a heartbeat to look up a technology topic because those are the articles that are the most up to date and the community is sort of self-policing. They'll keep it current. But if you use it for something that is potentially controversial. And one example I like to show is the article on the Armenian massacre, for example. That article, if you look at the history of it, and everything is transparent in Wikipedia as it is in most wikis, so that you can look at what people have, the whole history of the editing process, and you see where there have been revert wars. Somebody will write a piece and then someone else will correct it. The original person will revert it back to the way it was, and so on and so on. Then if you look at the profiles of those authors, and the way the people describe themselves, you have to wonder, do I want to trust this information based on, you know, the 16-year-old guy in Denmark who's written this article? So I think it's one of those technologies that has fantastic potential. I would love to see use of it, for example, at uni, at any school, because I think that it's a great way for students to use information that they get and create it into something and share it. But the wikis that are out there, you just have to be careful.
All right, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Michael.
Thanks so much for calling. Yeah, Wikipedia just amazes me because, and I don't know, if people haven't experienced it, they may not completely understand. Absolutely anyone can edit anything on Wikipedia, and you don't have to log in or have some special software. You do it right through your web browser. And like you say, on certain topics, this is an amazingly effective way to do things. And you can roll it back. If somebody vandalizes a particular page, then it can, you know, the previous version is still there, saved, you know, and it can be restored. But the thing that makes me, it's actually a very hopeful thing that it can, people can collaborate and they can build something, a knowledge base that is very, very effective.
Yes, it's pretty exciting, really. And it's very democratizing in that way, I think.
Well, let's go on and talk with some more listeners. Next up, someone in Savoy, line number two. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. How you doing?
Good.
You know, we use the technical libraries over at the U of I and quite a bit, and there's a major revamping of the chemistry library going on now, and they're trying to go as much electronic as they can,
right.
And they're taking many of these. You know, like the paper versions of Chem Abstracts, you know, like they go all the way back.
Right.
And they're essentially taking them out of the building and locking them up. And, you know, there's been a decision made by a committee with a lot of people's input, but there's a lot of materials being taken out of the library and taken over to Oak Street and just locked up. And then hopefully you'll be able to use the electronic searching mechanisms that they have in place, which is two-tiered. One will be only a limited searching ability will be available to the public, and then there's a much more advanced searching service available to university people. And, you know, we've used that library for many, many years, and we've always been able to find what we want in that library. And I've always thought the purpose of a library was to have the material in one place where you could find it, not necessarily go and hope that it's on a CD and then have to walk, you know, and have to go all the way across campus to find, you know, if it's not there, to go over to Oak Street and try and find it. I just wonder, you know, what's your opinion on this type of attitude?
Oh, these are hard questions because it's hard to have it all in today's environment. And that's what we want. We want to have it all. The online access at some point in time, I mean, this is another thing we try to get across to students, is that and you're exactly right, not everything is online and not everything is the way you want it to be online. I think that in the case of Oak Street, and I should probably explain that to the listeners, this is the library has built a high-density storage facility. We call it Oak Street because it's out on Oak Street in Champaign, and it's it's going to house about 800,000 volumes. And I actually spent a week there at the beginning of the summer, and I think I saw some of those volumes of Chem Abstracts that you're talking about.
Yeah, and they're not indexed either.
Right. Well, there are. I'm getting a little bit out of my element here because I think they you can get to the indexes. I'm not sure if they're next to the actual volumes, but I would probably have to refer that question to somebody who knows more. But I do know that they're making tremendous efforts so that it's totally possible to retrieve materials. In fact, everything that has been sent over there has gotten first-class treatment in terms of preservation and indexing and high quality cataloging, so that some of those things which nobody even knew existed before, they will know they exist now that they are in Oak Street. It's sort of ironic. And they have a nice reading room, incredible climate control. I went into where the stacks are, the 48-foot ceiling or whatever it is, and Lisa gets up there on her forklift and can lift those things down. So I think it's going to be certainly less convenient in a certain way, and in other ways, those volumes are going to last a lot longer and get better treatment. It's a tough one, though, I understand where you're coming from.
Yeah, I guess, you know, we've used that library for many years, and it, in my opinion, it's going to make it much more difficult to find exactly what you want. And we've been able to go over to that library. And I don't care how obscure it is, we've been able to find it.
Yeah.
And now it's going to be, in my opinion, very fragmented, and it's going to be very difficult to find something that's very important. And the other thing I'd go and mention, too, is there's a lot of information, really, these electronic services. They just drop off a cliff after about 1980.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of important information that's very relevant today that was done in the 40s. And I'll tell you what, it's going to be hard to track it down now.
It's something that we have to work on and the industry has to work on. Yeah, it's a problem, and I wish kids understood that, that there was valuable stuff printed before 1980.
Well, there's a lot more there we could talk about, but we have a couple callers I want to include as many as we can before we run out of time. Let me just quickly mention again, since we're well past our midpoint, we're speaking with Frances Jacobson Harris, author of the book I Found It on the Internet, Coming of Age Online, published by the American Library Association Books. She's also the librarian at University High School here in Champaign-Urbana. If you want to join us in the time remaining, we have about 20 minutes left in this hour, Focus 580, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. We have a caller on line number one from Slaterville Springs, New York.
Cool.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning. I was calling to mention something that you guys have alluded to quite a bit in the show but haven't talked directly about, which is the need for critical reading and thinking skills when using any kind of media, particularly the Internet, because you can find all kinds of things using Google and other search engines, but if you don't understand the origin of the information or maybe the point of view of the people that are writing it, you could easily be misled.
Oh, exactly. Oh, I could talk for many hours about that topic. And so for me, I think that's where librarians do become very important. And what we really try to work on a lot with teachers in collaborating with teachers. Just as an example, the rest of this week I'll be working with our seniors on a kind of a media literacy project. They're going to be comparing news stories. And one interesting exercise is to go to Google News and just type in a topic, for example, Iraq-Israel, which isn't in a way even a topic, but what they bring up as news sources is very interesting, and I have to read their information about how they define a news source, but you really get a gamut there. It's a huge range. I'd say probably a good chapter of my book is about teaching kids to evaluate information, whether it's online or not, but certainly the online environment is a very volatile one. It's essentially the Internet is like a giant Wikipedia. Anybody can put anything there. I think that when you have kids publishing their own information online, which they are doing more and more, it does give them a real insight. They know right away that if they can put it there, then anybody can. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they're good consumers. I have an exercise that we do with ninth graders called Who Done It, where they have to when you do a search, instead of like a library catalog taking you to a book, and you can take the book off the shelf and the book has a title page and a table of contents, instead a search engine can take you to the middle of a website and you don't know where you are. So I give them several examples of websites and they have to figure out what that website is, write a citation for it. And it's a really, really challenging exercise, I think.
The other thing I'd like you to address is the use of and the concept of free software. Eben Moglen, who's a Columbia Law School attorney, has called free software the largest body of knowledge in existence. Freely available body of knowledge in existence, which means that people can access the source code and many other tutorials and so forth so that they can learn without any encumbrances. And I wonder how you think this fits into the transformation of the libraries and learning.
Gosh, you know, I haven't thought a lot about that. I think it probably needs to fit in there more. I mean, in other words, I think that we could create better wikis if we. Are you talking about things like getting away from using standard software from big corporations?
Well, what I'm getting at is that proprietary software, mm-hmm. which you're talking about, doesn't provide an opportunity for people to learn much about it. Free software, on the other hand, provides complete opportunity
to
learn things about
it. Well, yeah, it definitely. And I think it's a way when you look at somebody's source code, certainly that's how I help myself fix a web page. You learn so much more than you would otherwise, and then everyone has an opportunity to improve it. So I think we're just getting started on that path.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thanks
so much for the call. Another caller waiting on line number 3 in Urbana. Good morning.
Oh, hi, how are you?
Good.
The Internet is actually an interesting concept in and of itself, but when you're talking about the democratization of information and these Wikipedias and things like this where people can enter there and edit anything, access to information should be democratic where
yes.
anybody can access it. But when you have the content itself, is democratic, and you don't have critical thinking, then how do you know what you're looking at has any validity at all? And you could even go into the scientific realm. You could go to, you know, opinion pages, which are obviously, you know, everybody has the right to their opinion. But then it goes into the philosophy of epistemology, which is the study of knowledge and the validity of knowledge in and of itself. And I'm all for democracy, but I'm really leery of all these expositions about, anybody can edit this and anybody can edit that.
Right.
Right? Because the old system of where you got a book and you had a group of editors, and I would call them validators, you know, especially in technical journals, so that if everything becomes open, then it becomes chaos.
Right.
And that's sort of what the Internet is now anyway. As you say, anyone with a computer and a web page builder can create it, you know, and that's why there are billions and billions of web pages, but sort of this over-democratization has a tendency to have a huge negative, because the earlier caller who said something about, you know, people who need critical thinking, that's one of my biggest problems with a lot of people I've dealt with and I used to teach, was that they didn't think about what they were looking at, as if like they accepted it because it was either written by someone or on a page or in a book that it had validity. So thusly, there was no critical thought involved at all. And I just that's my opinion about this, and thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah, it's very true. That's why you need librarians. But also I think that this is an important place for schooling in general. One of the things schools need to do is to bring critical evaluation of websites into the curriculum in a very direct way. And so, for example, when we have internet filtering software, that that makes it difficult. Another thing that makes it difficult is when schools limit use of the internet to quote-unquote curriculum material only, because that's not what kids are going to do when they're out of school. So I think it's very important instead within the curriculum to pull in a lot of disparate web information, and within the environment where you've got a teacher, where you've got some scaffolding, have kids do critical analysis of the information they find online, and don't just block it or just pretend that, you know, that's for somebody else to deal with. We need to take it as a mission in schools.
We have just about 10 minutes left with our guest, Frances Jacobson Harris, discussing her book, I Found It on the Internet, Coming of Age Online. She's a librarian at University High School here in Champaign-Urbana, and certainly has had a chance to interact with young people learning how to use information and communication technologies, as we've been discussing. If you'd like to join us in the time remaining, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. I wanted to maybe shift a little bit. There's a lot in the book, and I'm sure we won't get to everything, but some of the other kinds of issues that you run into when you give people tools like computers and the internet, and some of the trouble that people can get into.
Yes.
And, you know, I guess I'm talking about behaviors that we find, you know, they're sort of quasi-legal, like file sharing. You know, people are engaged in perhaps violating copyrights, and they don't completely understand exactly what that means and have different attitudes about it, for example.
Right.
You know, so maybe we could talk about that a little bit. It seems like some people say, well, it's out there, mm-hmm. and you quote some students in the book, it's on the web.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's free game.
Right, right. And some of that is developmental. It's really hard when you're 12 or 13 years old to understand this idea of intellectual property and ownership and what it means. And in terms of the larger issue of behaviors online, one of the first things we ran into, the stereotypes you have about kids and the internet is that two things will happen. One is they'll get to pornography, and the other is that predators will get to them. And what we found out almost immediately was that neither of those things were happening, at least as far as I could see. But instead, it was the way they behaved towards each other. And so we've spent a lot of time in class working on these intangible issues like intellectual property and like how to treat other people online or offline. We've even pulled our counselor into it because that's the reality. When they go online, there are certain barriers that come down. They don't see the face of the other person when they say something rude. They don't there are certain privacy issues that they don't get. If you copy someone's instant message into an email that you send to someone else, or put it on your profile, what that might mean. And so topics like all those ethical quandaries are, I think, also very, very important areas for schools to get into. And because they are developmental and they are persistent and they've always been there, just like horsing around in the library has always been there. But it's incumbent upon us in this age to include them in our teaching and learning environment.
Well, I was just going to say it's a teaching and learning opportunity if mm-hmm. someone's paying attention.
Right. Well, and they do
yeah.
if you tell them stories about themselves. And that's kind of the way we use and this is probably one of the things I feel most strongly about it, if you say don't do it, and this is kind of what's happened, I think, in some of the programs we've had in place for a long time, like programs like DARE or the abstinence programs, where you just say don't do it without sort of engaging them at a deeper level where they start thinking about who might be affected by these behaviors. So what people are now starting to do is more of a Socratic dialogue method where you really talk about these things and wrestle with the issues. And if you make it really immediate and talk about this is what happened here and this is who got hurt, it's totally engaging. It's the best attention I've ever had from students ever.
We have another call to include. Let's do that. Someone in Kankakee on line number 4. Good morning.
Your caller is a ways north up the road on the Illinois Central Railroad and on Interstate 57.
Mm-hmm.
He sees young people here accessing the Internet where accessing books would be more effective and efficient. And he sees young people here using the Internet for what he regards as trivial games, but he has great faith that young people also are using the Internet for productive, valuable, innovative things. Can you support his supposition in this regard with evidence of innovative, valuable, productive uses by young people?
Oh, completely. You know, you've heard it said that the job of a child is to play. I mean, that's their work, because when they play, that's how they learn. And I would say that for teenagers, even when it seems like they're not being productive, so I'll answer this in two ways. Their job is, in a sense, is to socialize, because that's how they learn how to interact in society. That's part of their job. But in addition to that, when kids are doing this tremendous amount of multitasking, they are being quite productive. They're learning how to talk, how to speak. I would probably argue the point with anyone who says, you know, letter writing has died. That in certain way, I think it's had a fantastic rebirth with the use of email or instant messaging. Any English teacher could tell you that word processing, as an example, has been a wonderful way for kids to learn to edit and to improve their writing. And then when you are able to share it with other people using a communication technology or this can be done in the classroom or not, then you get feedback. And so, they are doing all those things, but they are definitely being productive.
Well, just a quick follow-up to that, and I don't know what kind of applications are in the library as far as like Photoshop, mm-hmm. maybe. I don't know if that's probably more in the computer lab and things like that.
Right.
But, you know, video editing and audio production kinds of software that is now, you know, really cheap and really good.
Right.
And people and students, young people, very young people, are using this stuff and learning how to tell their own story. They're learning narrative skills. They're learning how to craft art and storytelling. And at a very young age, in a very powerful and effective way. And that's not trivial.
No, it's not at all. I mean, they are creating content in a way that they never could before. And in a way that is very compelling for them. The motivation factor is quite high.
Well, we just have about 2 minutes left. I wanted to ask you, maybe as our last question, you write about learning how to see on the web. You know, information literacy we've been talking about, during this hour and so forth. There's so much to see on the web. There's so many. I mean, there are some dangers. There's some, you know, stuff that's not credible, or perhaps even, you know, hate speech and things like that.
Right.
What would you say in terms of how, well, maybe schools can approach this issue?
Right. The point of the book really is that we need to teach kids how to learn how to be and to learn how to see. And seeing is that critical evaluation piece. And where I think schools can do this is to bring the content in and hold teachers responsible for holding students responsible for evaluating the information they use. And it's to not be afraid of it. I guess I'm turning it on the teacher now a little bit, that to not hide behind, okay, you can only use two internet sources. I think that's an irrelevant argument at this point, because the distinctions are blurring. The information exists now in both formats. And to yet at the same time to expect their students to bring high-quality content to their work, and for students to be able to separate the good from the bad. It's the best thing they could be doing.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. There's much more we could talk about, yes. And we're sort of at the beginning of this transition, really,
yes.
I mean, in a sense. So a lot of us are still immigrants to the information world. But we will take that up, I'm sure, on another occasion. And for now, I will suggest for folks, if you'd like to read more, the book is I Found It on the Internet, Coming of Age Online. It is recently published by the ALA Press, the American Library Association Press, and the author has been our guest, Francis Jacobson Harris, and I'm sure it's in bookstores and libraries, I would hope, certainly.
Yes. I know it's being used as a textbook in the library school here, so I know you can get it on campus. You can order it from Amazon. Pages can get it for you, and Pages for all ages.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for being with us.
Okay, and thank you very much.